today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 94, we're in Madrid, where we'll be finding solutions to the current challenges facing Spain Incorporated.
People are saving like mad. I mean, this is not in Spanish culture. There was this culture of spending. I would like to see that back, because that would mean that we're enjoying life again, that we are positive about our future, and that we're confident we can overcome all this.
That was Javier Moreno, editor-in-chief of El País. We'll also be getting a briefing on the current state of Spain's foreign policy on Latin America.
You have to de-Ibero-Americanize the Spanish foreign policy, because it's not a foreign policy. We don't have a foreign policy towards its largest partner outside Europe. This is very strange.
That was Suzanne Gratia, senior researcher at the think tank FRIDE. And later in the program, we'll be talking to Pablo Alomar Salvioni, who's raising money for families affected by the Japan disaster with his Spanish Wine Solidarity Project.
I think wine, it's in a way, it's something that makes you feel like warm when you are with other people. So I was feeling that in that moment in Tokyo also, the humanity of wine, and I felt it could be an idea to do some action to help those people.
And now from Madrid, the Monocle Weekly, with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 10th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Madrid. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. And from this point forward, we're doing the show in Spanish, aren't we, Andrew?
No.
You said so last week.
I know.
Did you, Rob?
He did. He said so. He started with hola.
Yeah, he did.
And it ended with that.
Adios. I think that was about it. Did you have class last week?
Yeah, I have a class every week, and I feel very sorry for the woman who kind of teaches me, because it's
maybe when you go back you can do show and tell, you can fill a big bag at Madrid Airport.
At least I make her laugh every week. I know, but I'm not sure that's in the best outcome of an hourly lesson.
Is that just a one-on-one class?
Yes, it's a one-on-one.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you do that in your office?
No, in my office. I don't have my office. I go meet her.
Could be.
I would hate doing it in our office and kind of everyone listening into my kind of like murdering of the Spanish language. So I go and see her.
Did you notice that we gave Steve Bloomfield a swerve this week? We lost him at Heathrow.
Did we?
Yeah, well, look, he's not...
Well, I know, but you know, he's been around enough. He's, he could be on his own for a week.
He's been naked.
What'd you do with him, Rob?
CV. I left him on the luggage carousel.
Well, it's very spring-like in Madrid. We're happy to be here, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Me and Rob had a wander around this morning, and it was sunny and it was great. And yeah, it's always a thrill to be here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We were talking in the intro about solving some of Spain's problems.
And they would be?
No, I don't know what the solutions would be. It's just so nice.
Yeah.
It's just so good. It's great. When you come here, you come from London, and spring has sprung here, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah, because when you're flying over and just on the approach to, what's the airport called? Say it.
Barajas.
Barajas.
That's the right spelling, or that's the right pronunciation, Rob.
Sorry, I was talking about a small mining village in Wales.
No, but it already feels like late June rather than early April.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think it's a silly thing to say, but I do wonder when it comes to summer for some of these nations, when the weather is good and when people do decamp to the beach and when you have good weather, you know that good weather makes you feel slightly better. So I wonder if actually for the economy and for just kind of people's general well-being, actually living in a place where you do get better weather, you actually feel a little bit better about your environment and life and things. You know, when you're at the beach, you can slightly forget your woes. Whereas if you're living in a dark, miserable country that's suffering the same kind of economic problems, you'll probably be jumping off a cliff, I think.
Reykjavik, maybe.
Reykjavik.
Well, I'm sure some of our guests a little bit later will have a view on those things. The one thing I like when I'm in Madrid is the proper kiosks here, though. It's like still, we come back to it again and again, and I won't even go off on a rant about the newsagent chain which occupies Terminal 3 at Heathrow. I went to the stand this morning because, I always like to re-merchandise the magazines, and we've got one of those sort of clip-on monocle stands where that's where a magazine is supposed to be. It's very easy. It goes in the same place every month, you would think. Empty.
Well, we can.
And it might be good news. I mean, it might be good news because we're sold out. But somehow I don't think so.
Well, we can tell you on Grand Vier it's working because we saw that.
Yeah, we saw a couple of nice sort of box out.
Did you?
Monocles.
Okay.
Yeah. Things, yeah.
Full of our magazines.
So once we're out of studio, we can maybe have a little tour.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but anyway.
Coming up on your left.
Exactly. No, but I think that there needs to be more freestanding kiosks on the streets, not just of London, in many other cities.
There's a few lovely ones here that we walked past earlier today and yesterday. There's one with a sort of huge Beaux Arts, looks like it shows a huge Beaux Arts kind of lampshade. Yeah, so you can, and it was raining, so it was kind of great. So people kind of like reading their newspapers, having a cigarette under this awning, and it's got this beautiful thing. It's like a huge petal.
I'm going to really look at that as well. Mm. And I see that you've managed to dip into the newsstand as well. You've got your copy of Al Pais, and we'll be talking to the editor in a moment. I think when he slides through the door. But you've got your copy of Hola. Who's featured on this particular cover, Rob?
Well, I think this is a Spanish prince. Who's this? Yeah, Spanish prince and his children.
Okay.
Who else have we got? We've got some.
Who's the lady in red?
Latin lovelies, and that is Adriana Abascal.
Do you know her?
I do now.
Yeah, it's coming. the one thing about media here is when I was in Korea a couple of weeks ago, the magazine that everyone wants to get their hands on, and they just had their fifth anniversary, is one of our favorites in the office, which is the Spanish edition of Architectural Digest. And on the current cover, and if you saw the current cover, Andrew, it says sexy. I guess that's a word that travels. Have you learned that word in your classes yet?
No, I haven't learned that word. I've learned some other kind.
Oh, wait, as Rob said last week, you only got the letter C
so far.
It just means
his six beautiful interiors.
No, but it is interesting that this is one title, though. You know, going back to sort of the sort of sunny, optimistic sort of point, you can be sitting in London on just the greyest of grey days in February. And you know, and this could be at home or even in the office, though we don't have a lot of great days in the new office. But if the weather is miserable, the Spanish edition of AD comes in, and it's just all sunshine and orange and hot woods, and I don't know, it looks beautiful.
Yeah, it does. So, it's always, that's the thing. Sort of every other German one, obviously nice.
Very nice.
But it's
a bit stern.
It's a bit, there's a sense of austerity about it.
Yeah, Margaret Meyer versus the editor Monza here, you know, two very different characters.
And let alone the American one. The American one is just like, oh my God.
No, it's unreadable.
OMG.
Well, it's also sort of, I don't know whether it's ring flash or what it is, but just the way all of those homes are shot, they all look the same.
Yeah, we did notice that there's another word that travels internationally.
Which is?
Oh my God. There's a magazine here on the newsstand called Oh My God.
No. There is actually.
Yeah, yeah. It's aimed at a gay reader, I think, but it's called Oh My God.
I think of course, you didn't go anywhere near it.
It was next to El País.
Yeah, he said it's aimed at a gay reader, I think, from the cover.
What it was like sort of, you know, a parade of rainbow flags, and
there was a lot of oil used on the cover, and it's not a cookery magazine.
Right. Well, now amidst crippling levels of unemployment and the threat of a banking crisis to match neighboring Portugal's, what does Spain now have to do to refocus its economy and remain a strong and influential voice in Europe and the world? Well, joining us now in studio is Javier Moreno, editor-in-chief of El País, also part of this group as well, which owns this particular station as well. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
I thought I would start. Maybe we should focus on the state of Spanish media, and I'm wondering if Spanish media is perhaps a reflection of the state of the economy in this country right now.
We're going through a crisis, like I think most of the newspaper industry around the world. I mean, it's not much different than that. I mean, if you see at what's happening in the UK or in France, where the highly influential French newspaper Le Monde has been struggling and needed a rescue a couple of months ago. So we're exactly in the same position. The thing is that in Spain, we're going through a crisis of our own, falling consumption, the bursting of the bubble, real estate bubble. So it's especially complicated for us here. But I think this is worldwide. I mean, circulations are falling, ad revenues are falling. We're trying to reinvent ourselves in the digital era. And this is pretty much the same all over the world.
Right. And would you say that, you know, yourselves, I mean, aside, obviously, there's a lot going on within this group. But does anyone have any solutions on the Iberian Peninsula right now? Anyone you sort of look to from a competitive point of view, your fellow peer set, you think, oh, I mean, maybe they do have some ideas. Because I think the one thing we always talk about is just the amount of design innovation we've always seen from this part of the world. I mean, the sophistication of Spanish newspapers, the supplements that come with them has always been very, very strong editorially.
Yeah, we revamped our design like 3 years ago. And it took charge 5 years ago right now. And 2 years after that, we made a major revamp, the first one actually since the newspaper was launched in 1976. There is this very interesting point. We never lost money. I mean, when you look at major newspapers all over the world, they've been suffering three very painful years since the economic and financial crisis started. And even through those very, very bad years, we've managed to stay a profit-making newspaper. Mm. That makes a difference, for us at least. I mean, this is not the case of the rest of our competitors in Spain, which have been losing money since the crisis started. But that gives us a vantage point to reinvent ourselves in the digital era.
Yes.
And that's what we're focusing on right now.
If you look at the media consumption habits of Spanish consumers, are you benchmarking against potentially other Latin American countries, other countries in Europe, in terms of how people go about, you know, what their morning habits are digitally versus when they're, you know, moving to print, then, you know, when are they tuning into radio, when are they watching television? Would you say this is a special or peculiar market in terms of tastes?
Yes. This is a country where you just sell like 100 newspapers for every 1,000 people, which is very, very low. I mean, when you compare with Norway or Sweden. And I mean, these are people we look at with envy. Why is this so in Spain? I guess, my guess would be that this is a country that has suffered long dictatorship. We've been under Franco for 40 years. That didn't do very much to help readership, newspaper circulation. And this is a country where TV arrived first and democracy. So that's not a very good point to start with.
Do you think also for the, at the moment with the economy in such kind of difficult situation, when you're making up your front page every day and you've got unemployment rates at 20% and there's problems with the banking, do you think actually for the average reader that when they look at the morning newspaper, that it's difficult if it's bad news every day? Are you aware of that as editor-in-chief? Do you sometimes say, look guys, we just need something a bit more positive on the front page?
Yeah, that's a very complicated situation to make a newspaper. I remember I was once, before becoming editor-in-chief of El País, I was in charge of Cinco Días, which is a daily a business newspaper, Business Daily, for this very same group. And that was a catastrophe. I mean, how can you sell business newspapers if stocks are falling every day, if people see how their wealth is waning? It was crazy. It was much more difficult to make a business newspapers in times of crisis than the general news. I mean, you always have Japan, you always have the Olympic Games. So you have to try to compensate on your front page. But again, it's very difficult. But my experience as editor of business newspapers in times of crisis has helped me a lot.
Not much happier in the seat of El País. If we went and eavesdropped on a boardroom meeting at Prisa, would they say that really their future is Latin America, that they think that, you know, this group, its future is going to be made in the likes of Argentina and Colombia and elsewhere?
Yeah, but you don't need to eavesdrop on any meeting on Prisa. That's our official position. We're trying to make El País, and we're trying to make the Prisa Group something reference for the Spanish-speaking world on both sides of the Atlantic. That's what El País has always been right from the start. I mean, if you look at the paper right now, all major writers, Latin American writer is right now at El País, starting with Mario Vargas Llosa, who won the Nobel Prize last year. But we had García Márquez when he still wrote, and Mario Benedetti, and every major Latin American writer. So that's been our aim, and that's been our goal right from the start. If you look not just at El País, but the whole Prisa Group, we've got a publishing house, Santillana, which is present in 22 Latin American countries. And we make more money from the publishing house in Brazil, for example, than from Spain. So it has already changed. I mean, the shift has already happened. We want to focus on that, especially on the newspaper, because with digital technology, I mean, with the internet, it's going to be much more easier to be present throughout Latin America than it used to be when you had to print and distribute and sell physical copies in all those countries.
So that means that El País really becomes a super brand for the Spanish-speaking world.
Right.
I mean, you might already say that it already is, but that's obviously the ambition.
Right. That was always ambition. I think right now, I mean, in the past 5-7 years, we're also having the means to achieve that goal, to achieve that ambition, which was at the heart of the newspaper already 35 years ago when it was born.
Hmm. I just want to go back to, you talk about the relaunch and or the redesign of the newspaper. Sitting on the newsroom floor, why has Spain always had this very strong graphic design tradition in newspapers? Because as you say, you know, the numbers are not the same as they are in the Nordic world. Yet there are so many newspaper design doctors. I mean, you look in this city, you look in Barcelona as well. So many experts in overhauling papers. Is that, or is it partly because people have been trying to figure out the formula, so they became experts here?
Does this mean that you like the design of El País?
I do like the design of El País, and I think, you know, a lot of the other newspapers as well. And I'm not trying to be diplomatic, mm-hmm. but I've always thought that the Spanish kiosk is very sophisticated from a newspaper design point of view. Andrew, I'm not sure what you think, but sometimes I think there's just a neatness also to the Spanish format versus, I think, what we have on our own newsstand in the UK.
Yeah, no, I worked for the independent newspaper in the UK for a long time, and every time that newspaper was redesigned, it was redesigned by a team from Barcelona. They flew in people from Barcelona. The Independent is a Spanish design newspaper.
I know.
And you know, to the point that we had people from their design companies planted into the newspaper who stayed there for months and months to make sure that people didn't go off track.
Are they still there, do you think?
I think they finally got home to the sunshine. But yeah, you know, but it was interesting. Spain was seen as the inspiration for, you know, what you should do with the newspaper.
Yeah, well, actually we tried, I mean, the design of El País stayed the same for almost 30 years. And once we decided to make a major revamp of the design, we looked for the best. Some of them were in Spain, like Oscar Mariné. We love Oscar Mariné's work, not just with newspapers. But then again, we looked for very good friends of mine in Scotland, and they helped us a lot. So so actually, the newspaper is half Scottish and half from Madrid in its new design. So it's not exactly the Spanish bit behind it, but we looked for the better. And the best was, in this case, coming from Edinburgh.
Mm. Before we started, you were just mentioning that you also maintain not just a bureau in Barcelona, but you have a fully fledged newsroom. Does that play out, or would we see the same thing anywhere else in Latin America? Do you, or are there ambitions to say to have a full newsroom in Mexico City and in Buenos Aires?
That's exactly the ambition. Actually, we tried once. We opened a full-fledged newsroom in Mexico, which had a short run, actually, between 1994 and 1997. And I was there because I was the...
I'd say by newsroom standards, that's quite a long run, actually.
I was editor-in-chief, or I was the person responsible for it, for that edition. Back in those years, I was very young then, and I had not an idea of how to run a newspaper. But that was our first foray into the market. Then, as you know, in 1994, I mean, just as we were launching the edition in Mexico, came the devaluation of the peso, the tequila crisis, and things got complicated, and we had to close down the whole thing 2 years after that. But it showed that that was our goal back then. So right now we print and sell physical copies of the newspaper in Mexico, in Argentina, in Chile, in Dominican Republic, and since 3 or 4 weeks in Miami. So I don't know when, but I can promise that we'll open a newsroom. And I think it's going to be Mexico, definitely.
Not Miami.
Not Miami.
No. we spend a lot of time, obviously, talking about media, but I want to focus on just the state of the economy. And, you know, as Andrew was asking earlier, there has to be this tricky balance between what those front pages look like and keeping, you know, the population reasonably happy and motivated, but while also giving them the state of play. And I'm wondering right now, what would you say are really, you know, the big challenges? Obviously, we've seen that from a leadership issue, we're not looking at the PM standing again in 2012, so we'll not be going for re-election. But beyond that, mood on the street right now, and are there any green shoots as it's springtime? Are people feeling better?
I'm afraid I can't see any green shoots, not at all. Consumption is falling since December. We had a pretty decent Christmas campaign. Everyone was selling quite a lot, and it looked like it could be the start of something, but it was not. I mean, we've seen consumption falling for 3 months. I think people are not happy. Obviously, we're not as bad as we were a year ago. I mean, last year we were risking a real European intervention. I mean, we faced possible bailout, and that would have spelled catastrophe for Spain. I think we've overcome that. But if you ask me, for people on the street, wages are stagnated or falling. People are not spending money. They're quite depressed. So it's very complicated.
I wonder if you think there's going to be a kind of a lost generation here in a way. I came here yesterday and I had lunch with a group of people, one of whom was a Mexican who's been living here as an architect. He's moving to the Netherlands because there's literally no work for what he's doing. Another guy who was an architect who's gone back into education because there's absolutely no work. Another guy who's a designer who's become a lecturer because there's no work in his field. In fact, out of 5 of them, only one of them was really confident that they had a job that could keep them here. And I wondered if you felt that, you know, for Spain as a nation, there was a risk of, you know, mass migration, you know, of people trying to go to, if they were educated, and had transferable jobs, going to Latin America, going to Mexico. It seemed a really kind of just, you know, it wasn't depression. It was just they felt that it was going to be so long before the economy turned around. They had to do something.
Right. Especially with everything having to do with the real estate crisis. I mean, you were talking about architects, obviously. They've been very hard hit because of the real estate bubble. But beyond that, I wouldn't say we're facing the risk of a last generation. We already have a last generation who are already 35 and who haven't had a single job, stable job in all his lives, with real income stabilized, making possible for them to buy an apartment or even move out of their parents' house. So that has already happened. That's not a risk for the future. Mm. That's happening. Mm. And that's very depressing for the for young people in Spain. The question is, will this lead to a mass immigration like 4 years ago? I hope not. Crises these days are much shorter than they used to be 4 years ago. Mm. So I really hope, or I really think that we'll be in a better situation in 2 or 3 years. But again, we'll see.
What should we say to end this on a high note? If the positive front page was going to the printers right now, opportunities right now, or even something prescriptive, I mean, what do you really think needs to happen right now? What would you like to see if you could, not say have a fictitious front cover, but certainly have a full manifesto front cover?
I mean, the question is how you get a change of mood in your population. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you see how much people are saving, this is increasing. I mean, people are saving like mad. I mean, this is not in Spanish culture because of many reasons, not because of partying and Madrid's night and the Movida and all that, but because we had so high inflation 20 years ago that it was useless to save. So there was this culture of spending. I would like to see that back, because that would mean that we're enjoying life again, that we are positive about our future, and that we're confident we can overcome all this. So if you ask me what would I like to splash on the front page of a place one day...
Responsible spending.
Responsible spending. Another way of the kind of spending we used to have a couple of years ago, but reasonable spending. That would be very... Very happy.
Excellent. Javier Moreno, editor-in-chief of El País. Thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Madrid. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Madrid. Now, Latin America may not be a top priority for the EU, but Spain remains a key investor in the region, second only to the United States. But are Spain's close ties with Latin America reflected in its foreign policy? And what more can be done to enhance this relationship? Well, joining us now in the studio is Suzanne Gratias, senior researcher at the think tank FRIDE, which is the Fundación para las Relaciones Internacionales y el Diálogo Exterior. How was that? Hope that worked. Welcome.
Yeah, fine.
I guess to start, if you were a young diplomat just coming out of foreign service school in Madrid right now, is there sort of a disconnect, whether you want to be assigned to Brussels and look after European affairs, or is it more interesting to be assigned to Santiago or Buenos Aires or Bogota because, you know, the game for this country is more in Latin America?
I mean, Spain's role is more important in Latin America than in Brussels in general. Because of the economic crisis, its weight in the European Union is diminishing. And it doesn't have really a large policy towards Latin America, but it's as you said, its main investor and also its main development for development assistance. It's number one also before the United States. So the economic and the development interests are really in Latin America. That's true, but it's more exciting maybe to be in Brussels than to be in Bogota. It depends what you're looking for, no?
Yeah, that could be debatable. But it also makes Spain quite unique from a foreign policy point of view that there is this, I mean, very direct daily link to former colonies and obviously certainly the economic heartland that exists there, because, you know, you could say that the same is not true for Germany. Germany doesn't have a sort of a natural part of the world that it can really look to. And so despite where the country sits economically right now, do you think that that's also an opportunity if it plays its foreign policy right as well?
I think so, because you have this Ibero-American community of nations, these Ibero-American summits every year in different Latin American and in Spain and Portugal. And Spain is like the leading force for this community of Ibero-American nations. And as the word says, Ibero-America, Spain perceives itself as part of Latin America, which is very strange. You have to understand that Spain has a kind of dual identity, two identities. One is the European, as you said, which is more important in terms of foreign policy. And then you have this Ibero-American connection, this close ties to Latin America, not only in economic terms, but also in political and cultural terms. Because if you think about the publishing or the editors, I mean, all is in Latin America. If you think about the whole culture, I mean, Spain wouldn't be nothing without Latin America in this sense.
Suzanne, I wanted to ask you about that cultural kind of the cultural closeness. We talked to the editor of El País, who's wanting obviously to expand Latin America, and I guess Spanish films, Spanish language films, big obviously in the territories in which they should be. But what's the attitude the other way around? Does the rest of Ibero America feel that it doesn't need Spain to tell it how to behave and what newspapers to buy and what films to watch? Are they happy consuming their own media, do you think?
Yeah, I think speaking in general terms, I think Latin America has its own, as you said, publishing industry and editorials and books industry, and is a cultural work in its own. No? It doesn't need Spain, but the large companies are based in Spain, and you have these entrance door Spain to the European market. So it's a twofold destiny, no? It's a twofold direction in a sense. But on the other hand, no one would say that. And if you go to Mexico, which is the closest partner of Spain in Latin America, nobody would tell you, I feel like Ibero-American, I'm part of Ibero-American culture. This is a very Spanish attitude, a very Spanish policy. It's like geopolitics. No, you want to be more through your Latin American partners. It's a kind of foreign policy platform, no, for Spain, this community. But in cultural terms, they are very close. All the books you see published are published in Spain mainly. So they need each other, no? In a sense.
So then at the end of last year, we did one of the first ever, I believe, soft power surveys, and we did a global ranking of those countries which really understand how to use their soft power. And Spain sits in a very interesting position, just off the back of what Rob was saying, that yes, on one side, you can look to the United States, and they publish a lot of Spanish language editions of American titles, and there's no shortage of Spanish language television that comes out of the U.S. But I guess when you look at perhaps truly original content and the role that these media companies play, and then if you look at music and if you look at film and everything else that comes out of this country, would you say that Madrid has a slightly stronger hand than Washington potentially when it comes to real soft power in Latin America?
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe yes, because it's much closer, because of cultural links are much more important than economic links. If we think about the role of Japan in Latin America, nobody's ever again talked about Japan's role in Latin America. So economics is much less important than cultural links. Mm. But you have to take into account that in the U.S. you have this large migration, Mexican from Mexico, from other Central American countries, and it's going to be interdependent. Both depend on each other much more than before. It's the largest minority in the United States. So both are, in a sense, competitors in Latin America, Spain and the United States. You have like a triangle relation in this sense. But taking into account Latin America, I mean, Brazil is the seventh largest economy in the world and Spain is number 9 or 10. So there is also asymmetry between the countries. Spain is not the real leader. It's not a hegemony, you know. It's not a major power in Latin America. It's just a middle power, no?
I wondered if you were sitting here in the foreign ministry, is it a complicated game knowing how to play the relationships with each of those countries in Latin America? We saw a very kind of public spat a year ago between the king here and Hugo Chavez, when there was some cross words about what the king actually thought about him. When you see Cuba potentially opening up more for business, are they trying to fine-tune what they do there? Is it really country by country they're having to work out a policy for how to deal with, you know, Latin America?
They should have that, but there is no bilateral policy really, because you can see the constant shifts between towards Cuba if you have a PP government, a conservative government, or a socialist government. They are constantly changing its policy towards Cuba, Venezuela, Honduras, and there is a kind of, you have to understand Latin America as part of its domestic policy. It's an intermestic issue, the same as in the United States. There's some interesting parallelism in this sense. And there's no real bilateral policies. You have six strategic partners. I can't really remember which are these six partners. But there are six special relations among them, Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, I guess. But there's no real definition on what the bilateral links are about, which countries are more important for Spain's interests, which are less. If you see it in terms of investment, it's Brazil, it's not Mexico. If you see it in cultural terms, it's obviously, because of the language, for cultural reasons, it's Mexico. But those are the two main partners of Spain. And now it's a lot is going on Brazil, no? Because of its global position, because of Spain and the Ibero-American community. Mm. And then you have Central America as a historic close relationship. So it depends. And Cuba, obviously, as its last colony in Latin America.
Well, Cuba just seems fascinating because, you know, it is the Spanish hotel operators who went in there early on, and it feels ripe for, if anything changes in Cuba, it would be an amazing opportunity for Spanish companies to go in. But as you say, you don't see a huge amount of policy, you know, connecting Havana and Madrid.
Yeah, Cuba is one of the main topics in Spanish Latin American policy. You have seen that also in Brussels, there's a large influence, and it's like a mirror. No, what happens in Madrid is not happening in Brussels a bit. And Spain is defining a large part of the Latin American policy of the EU. No, among them, Cuba. We have a common position towards Cuba because of Spain, because of the special relations. But as I said before, it's a bit a domestic policy. If you look at the constituency, also it's a domestic debate here in Spain. If we get closer to the Cuban regime or more distant from the Cuban regime, it's always a problem here. You have always an internal debate. But the investments in Cuba are not really large. No? The only advantage for Spanish business is that they are there, they are present, they are investing there. But they are not the main investor. The main investor is Canada.
It sounds, if you were sitting at the foreign ministry here and you had the foreign minister's hat on, you'd be telling people to sharpen up, well, not just their policies, but it sounds that perhaps people in the embassies are maybe not quite as efficient as their, let's say, their Turkish partners. Or if we look at other foreign ministries right now, the Brazilians, who we recently featured, who are incredibly savvy and sharp. Do you think there's a bit of work that needs to be done on the part of the foreign ministry here?
On Latin America?
In general, in terms of the role that Spain plays, and also having a coherent policy that everyone understands.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done, as you said, not only with regards to Latin America, but at least you have a kind of definition of Africa now, because we have a Plan Africa, a Spanish policy towards Africa, but not the same for Latin America. Latin America is a kind of tradition, but not a policy, you know. It's very strange because of these special reasons, the special links between Spain and Latin America. But I think there needs to be done a lot of work with relation to Latin America. You have to de-Ibero-Americanize the Spanish foreign policy because it's not a foreign policy. We don't have a foreign policy towards its largest partner outside Europe. This is very strange. So I think there needs to be a lot of work has to be done.
Great. Suzanne Gratias, Senior Researcher at Frida. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You listen to Monocle Weekly. We're in Madrid. Back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Madrid, where it's going to be a bit of a cultural experiment. It's cultural tapas today, isn't it, Rob?
I'm always hungry for that.
Well, hopefully thirsty, because you might recall that some months ago, remember we had that little quiz? We did that Music for Wine quiz.
It was quite a successful quiz. We weren't very good at answering the questions, but people...
Well, no, because I don't think we had a lot of wine in studio, because a very lovely gentleman, Mr. Pablo Alomar Salvioni, he had this... Well, the CD, which we sort of matched up, and we would decide, you know, what wine to go with which song.
We got kind of confused, didn't we? We kind of enjoyed one bit of it more than the other, I think.
Mm. And then also, I think our knowledge of Spanish wine ran out rather quickly, didn't it?
It was. We were very willing to learn, but probably it wasn't the right environment to learn.
Well, anyway, I'm looking through the control room. I think we have some music lined up. I can certainly see that in front of Pablo, we have also some very nice bottles lined up, and I should welcome you to the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Maybe just a little backgrounder. You know, some months ago we were talking about the music and wine pairing, but maybe explain your business a little bit to us.
What I do in Salt in the Earth basically is to source wine for the Asian market, mainly Japan. Then I obviously work Hong Kong, Korea, and other Asian markets. But from a point of view of family-run wineries, they are not willing to become very, very big. They are not willing to become a multinational Chilean or American wineries with a sort of good price for what you drink and a story behind them.
Mm. I mean, let me ask you, just when you mentioned the family vineyard versus, you know, family and families that certainly don't want to become like big multinationals. How does the market break out in Spain? The big players, I guess some of the familiar names people would know from the supermarket shelves, etc., versus the independents. Is it sort of 60-40, half-half?
It would be like, 60-40. But nowadays it's getting like this kind of underground wineries are getting the voice. It's a kind of revolution now, because people from the economic boom in Spain, everybody wanted to have a winery. So they were building houses, and the next thing was building a winery for the family and all that. So these things now have changed. And now all these big wineries are empty or they've been sold or they are doing nothing there. So now these small wineries are taking the lead, I think, in Spain.
So you're saying also there's a few bargains on the market if someone wanted to...
Sure, sure. I was in Hong Kong like 3 weeks ago and they told me, could you source me a winery? And I was like, a wine or winery? No, a winery. So I was, oh, yeah, okay, I will.
So you think that maybe sort of in 36 months we could be seeing Hong Kong or Japanese families owning property?
Sure. I'm more than sure that it's going to happen here, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Andrew, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting because we've seen that already happening in California, that many of the biggest states, you know, are owned by Japanese companies or are owned by people who are not Americans who want to own a wine estate because it can represent, you know, a bit of their culture and they can start making wines themselves. Do you think that the Spanish market traditionally has been less open to that?
I mean, we are a Spanish wine and I'm not saying we are bad or good, but we are Spanish. And first they are the French, second the Italian, and we are fighting for, because we have the quality of the wines. We have the terroir that is the most rich terroir in the whole world. We have all kind of terroirs in one country, in Spain. So we are very rich in that sense, but we are not good in marketing. and we have to do something about that.
We were saying earlier about, you know, opportunities when we asked the editor of El País. So I think that's maybe opportunity number three then, you know, branding for Spanish wines.
I was just going to say that the one thing I think does help you is what's been really interesting is over the last kind of 5 years, as you travel the world, you see more and more of these kind of jamón bars, you know, that they, in a way where the Spanish food goes, then the wine can come in after it. And I wondered if that had kind of helped you in the selling of, you know, of your wines.
Yeah, it helps a lot because now, especially in Japan and Korea, starting now, there are many tapas bars, pinchos bar. And I would say there is a step. The first step, they just want to do a Spanish pinchos or tapas bar that... basically, the quality is really bad. So it's not good. And if the food is not good, then the wine, they are looking for cheap brands. And it's not a good match. But recently, I'm surprised every time I travel to Tokyo, Osaka, there are very, very good quality Spanish and tapas bars. And they are also trying to pick up like funny wines to have with the food. So in that sense, it's growing that the demand for quality products from Spain.
Mm-hmm. Rob, how should we run today's session? Do you think we should play music first and then we have the bottles of wine lined up there?
But I think we should probably have a drink and then
play the music.
And then Pablo can tell us what sort of song he.
Then we
he
can sing as
with.
Well.
Okay, fine. I think that sounds fine. Okay, so maybe these are you mentioned that the Japanese are looking for funny wines, but I'm not sure if these are funny or not. But I guess they might be from smaller vineyards.
Yeah, they are all from smaller vineyards. Well, I brought two completely different white wines, so you can check. One is kind of fruity, and the other one is very dry, but you can feel more the terroir, so it's a good match. Then a red wine that represents what we are doing now in Spain.
Okay. I want to go for... Well, you choose which one you'll pour first.
Okay, maybe we start with the very dry one.
Okay. See, I like that label on that one. You said there's a branding issue, but that is a fantastic label.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Brezo.
Brezo, yeah. This is from the north of Spain, from Bierzo, Castilla León. It's just near Galicia. So it's a French guy who's doing this wine. Well, his grandparents were Spanish. And then he wanted to come back to his roots. And it's a kind of biodynamic winery. He's using the old techniques, and he's doing what he was thinking his grandfather was doing at that time. So
right. Cheers.
Chin-chin.
Very nice. Now, when they say that a wine is biodynamic, this means what? What doesn't go into it, or what does?
There's a lot of things about this biodynamic. Basically, it's a natural wine that has no chemicals. Mm-hmm. And then if you want, you can work the land as... there is a book that's like a treat of biodynamic techniques. So I don't know if you hear the bull, the kind of sheet of the cows into a horn, and they put on the ground. And after some years, the ground becomes like a natural compost. Mm-hmm. So
you've done that in your garden at home, haven't you, Rob?
Yeah, I like, and we never call it manure either. We always call it shit of cows. Say it like it is.
Yeah, and then also they pick up the grape when the full moon is there. So it's a kind of spiritual thing, and the taste. Maybe you like it or not, but it's natural.
Yeah,
in a way,
it tastes very young.
Yeah,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
Andrew, do you want this in the fridge at the office?
I like it. It's a little bit too light and lemony for me.
Okay.
Vino verde.
Yeah, it's a little bit too crispy for me. Yeah.
Okay, all right. We won't be serving
Being
it.
Being honest.
No, it's fine. It's good, absolutely.
You? I mean, what do you think?
No, I like it, but I think it really needs to go with the weather. I mean, I'm not sure if it's just right for a studio in the centre of Madrid in April. But you know, if I was in Formentera on someone's boat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded by nice people,
precisely.
Good swim trunks, I think it would be great. I think you'd like it more than as well.
I think exactly. This is a wine that you have to have having some something something to eat. The next wine, the white wine we're going to have is different. It's a wine that
Andrew, drink up, come on. Okay, so this is from where?
This is from Rueda, which is just 1 hour from here, from Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Segovia, between Segovia and Valladolid, and it's a very fruity wine.
You like this, Blanc. Andrew, this is very fruity. You like this.
I wanted to ask you how the Asian palate is different to the Spanish. I mean, obviously it's not a part of everyday life like it is here, but is it about sweetness or dryness or red or white even? Is it as simple as that?
Depends on the country. For example, in basically now in China, you cannot sell white wine. Mm. Everybody wants red, very strong, powerful wines. In Japan, it's different. In Japan, with the food, with the sushi, everybody's thinking sushi, Japan, blah, blah. It goes well. But I think for those countries, they need education. And this is a thing that we have to do. The producers, the government have to educate people, because without education, everybody cannot drink, doesn't have their own opinion.
I like this one. It's very nice.
What is this?
It's also...
it's a Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring this Sauvignon Blanc because it's Sauvignon Blanc, French variety, in Spain. So it gives you the mark of Spain in a way, because if you drink a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or a French Sauvignon Blanc, you will get a different taste from the terroir as well. But here you...
It's almost slightly woody, nutty.
Yeah. I like this one.
Yep.
Mm, it is, yeah.
It's funny you say about education being needed in Asia, though. But don't you think education is needed in Europe as well? Because the funny thing about Spanish wines is, you know, although there's an amazing diversity and there's incredible quality here, actually, if you go to the UK, for example, people still think of it as a cheaper version of wines. There's still educating people who really like wines about Spanish wines. There's still some distance to go.
I agree, but I think now it's changing, especially in the US and in England. You have James's Robinson, who's helping a lot in Spanish wine. I mean, she likes the wine and she's always reviewing Spanish wines. And in America, Parker, the god Parker, helped us a lot, because he really likes this kind of strong wines in Spain. However, it's helping, but it's also making some damage, because we are making wines after him. So this is not good.
I think half the world seems to make a wine for Parker, right?
So this is a bit...
And is it a matter of having, say in Tokyo, there was a thing that seemed to be the Rioja craze 5 years ago, that you can't get a bottle for less than £8, which obviously isn't a huge amount of money, but it seemed to be quite a good thing that you couldn't buy. There was nothing on the shelves that was Spanish that was £4 or £5. Yeah. So people, you know, I always felt that Spanish wine was slightly more, was slightly rarer. And slightly more expensive.
Yeah.
Is that something that you try to do in Asia as well, to make it a slightly higher price point than the most basic French or Italian wine?
Well, in Japan now there is a kind of culture of Spanish wine, and it's amazing how the news travel from Spain to Japan. When there is a wine producer that makes a very interesting wine, it's almost sold out in Tokyo. However, in other countries, we need to make some kind of fashion out of the Spanish wine and not waste money like we did. I mean, the Spanish ethics, they did some time in Hong Kong. They spend a lot of money in one day, and that's it. Rioja was really famous, but then came Ribera del Duero. And then from white wines, we have the Rueda, very popular, and the Albariño, Rías Baixas in the north. That's it. It's a thing of marketing, as I said before.
And just maybe while you open up that bottle of red for us to sample, I'm happy to stick to the white, but we'll try the red all the same. You've also launched an initiative in Japan, and I know that you were there around the time of the Tohoku earthquake. Tell us a little bit about it.
When the earthquake happened, I was in Osaka on a train, so I didn't feel anything. However, I got a telephone call from a friend in nearby Tokyo, and he said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm okay. What happened?" "No, there is a big earthquake."
Okay. Oh, wow. You sound a bit like an earthquake there.
And actually, I was heading to a wine tasting that I had in Osaka. All the importers, they were calling me and saying, "Listen, we cannot go. This something happened and it's quite serious." And I say, "Okay, well then it's serious. Then I should cancel." But then I called the guy at the hotel, and he told me, "No, don't cancel. You know, now people is getting like panicking and they want to feel normal." So I say, "Okay, then we do it." Nobody came. However, all the customers in the bar bar of the restaurant, they were more than happy to drink Spanish wines. So from that point, I realized that maybe doing something with wine to help those poor people could be interesting, and not because everybody thinks wine is fine, we get drunk and we laugh and we don't take things serious. But I think wine, it's in a way, it's something that makes you feel like warm when you are with other people. So I was feeling that in that moment in Tokyo also, the humanity of wine, and I felt it could be an idea to do some action to help those people. So we started with this wine, Help Japan with Wine. That basically we're going to stick a label, a small label on the bottle that will participate. And this bottle will donate from 100 to 500 yen to the Red Cross in Japan. So I hope this will help a little bit to those victims.
And this is this will be both in restaurants and at retail?
Yeah, that will be in... So what, from our side, we're going to give this lower price. Mm-hmm. Then we expect that the distributor will also give a part of it, and then the restaurant will give also a part. So this 100 yen can become like 500 at the end. So I think it's a good money for this cause.
Great. Maybe while we pour that, we can have a little listen to...
It's some music, don't we?
A bit of music.
Yeah. It's a bit quiet, isn't it? There's only so much people want to hear us guzzling.
guzzling and gurgling.
What goes with the Tempranillo, Pablo?
I think as Tempranillo is a very Spanish grape, it would be a very Spanish song, like Spanish guitar, so flamenco from my friend Satoshi Hori would be...
Very Spanish name.
Yeah.
Satoshi Hori.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. Really beautiful.
And with the wine?
Even better, of course. No, I really like that. It was, I sort of was drifting off to thinking about our bigger audio project. I thought it would be something like that, just great for musical interludes. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? It's good.
You lose yourself in it. It's lovely. Rob, do you want to customize the mix as well? Do you have something for us?
I've got something for you as well. And these people are from Galicia, like our Sauvignon Blanc.
What would this go with? Wine 1, 2, or 3?
I guess we'd probably have to go with two because it's from Galicia.
Okay. Yeah.
They're called Colectivo Oruga, okay. And they're two guys, sort of two remixers and DJs and songwriters. But unfortunately, they've got the song and the album have got really English names.
Not worse than Dengue Fever, like last week.
Do you know what the name of the album's called?
What?
Too Many Knobs. It is. It's called that, but I think he means in terms of like an amplifier and a mixing deck.
Yes, of course he does.
I don't know whether this is a story in Oh My God.
I think it is. I think it's an Oh My God August cover story.
And the track is called Tired.
Is that again, Rob?
Colectivo Oruga. That's the name of the band.
Yeah.
You want me to say the name of the album again?
Say it.
Too Many Knobs.
And the single?
Too Many Cocks Spoil the Brothel. And the name of the song is Tired.
And that's what happens after too many knobs, right?
Exactly. That's why you need ice in your wine.
Absolutely.
So they're quite good. Do you like them?
Yeah, very nice. That's a nice little musical collective we've had. Pablo, you and I have business to discuss after the program because you're going to work on a wine. I was actually going to ask you as well, are you also looking at going the other direction and bringing wines from Japan potentially into Europe?
Yeah, I want to bring some sake. However, in Spain, it's very hard.
It's a hard sell.
It's hard because the Chinese already selling sake here and it's very cheap. And people don't have the sense. But it's the same. It's the same as there. You come here with a good sake and they say, oh, yeah, all are the same. This is expensive. We want a cheap one. But it's an education thing, so it will take time, but I will do that.
Great. Yeah. Well, we look forward to it. Pablo Alamo Salvioni, thank you very much. You're the director of Sourcing the Earth. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from Madrid. We're back in a moment with a few parting words. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly in Madrid, where it's time for a toast goodbye.
Yeah,
Andrew, you're on the red still.
Yeah, I'm on red.
I'm on number
great.
Two. What do you on?
I'm on number three. I'm on the red too.
You're on the red as well. Anyway, well, cheers, gentlemen. It was a very nice show.
Yeah.
Clink of glasses.
Salute.
Even. It's very, very good.
More Sunday mornings like this, I say.
Absolutely. I think sort of hitting a Spanish bottle, you know, well before noon is a very good thing.
Very good thing.
Andrew, where are you off to next? I mean, well, aside from sort of, you know, going and taking a bit of sun and everything else.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get out to Ankara over the next few weeks.
For some sun.
Not for some sun, for some work.
Right.
But for my son, I haven't really planned it yet.
Oh, right. I didn't know he had kids.
And you? Well, that sounds like you've got a holiday booked.
No, I don't have a holiday booked. But you know, last weekend I spent a lot of time trying to figure out where I should go. Do you know where I'm going?
Where are you going?
Now, I've been thinking, working back, I want to go to Formentera in August. Do a little bit of Sweden. Do a little bit of Switzerland. And I think once we finish the July-August issue, I think there'll be a good chunk of Italy probably as well. So I'm thinking that place that we featured actually in the Travel Top 50, the Locanda al Colle. I'm thinking about that, which is just near Pietrasanta.
See you there. I'm going to go there too.
Do you want to go there as well?
Totes. Let's do a radio show from
there.
Well,
I'm thinking about... Yeah, is it going to take five rooms? I mean, not just for me. But I mean, anyone who wants
to go along. Luggage.
I think a lot of luggage.
And knock down the walls between.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then maybe going to the San Pietro. And and then I'm not too far from Madrid. I want to go to the Hotel Edis that we had as well. Those wonderful little concrete boxes. Mm.
I have to have a Beirut trip this summer because I've got friends coming from Australia who I persuaded to book their holiday, so they're going there to Beirut for the summer, so I'm going to go and visit them.
I forgot we've got a company apartment there as
well.
You might as well use it.
I'll borrow it, thank you.
And Rob, where are you going?
Beirut sounds good actually as well.
Okay, good. There's
four
bedrooms.
I've got a bit of wedding action in Italy lined up, so I think there's going to be some stuff around.
You're still at that age where friends are getting married. it'll be over soon.
Yeah, I was going to say, me and Tyra at the age where they're getting divorced.
Yeah, exactly. For the second time. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alexander Mills, and our sound engineer here at the studios of Cadena Ser in Madrid was Jose Sendra. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our site. Next week, we'll be in Tokyo. But for now, from Madrid, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Senor Tuck.
I'm Roberto Bound.
And here to play us out is Satoshi Hore. Goodbye.
Bye.